Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight when Sarah Henderson makes a welcome return to the Institute. She was here some years ago, shortly after she entered the House of Representatives, and lost her seat at Corragamite recently due to a redistribution, but then returned to the Senate. So Sarah Henderson's made two first speeches, one in the Reps, and recently one in the Senate. And I'll introduce her briefly. She was a qualified lawyer, worked in the media, in Times of the ABC, and 10. She's worked in National Indigenous Television. She's worked at News Corp as a legal in the legal area, and she's also run a small business. So she's well qualified across a lot of grounds. And today, Senator Henderson is going to speak for us on the topic of reforming Australia's foreign investment law. Sarah Henderson, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everyone. It's wonderful to be here at the Sydney Institute once again, and I want to thank Anne and Jared very much for their very kind invitation. Now, full disclosure is required. Jared is related. He's my father, Michael's first cousin, and looks a little like my dearly departed grandfather, 20 years ago or more, perhaps more than anyone else in the family. He has a very dry Irish wit, even though there's probably a combination of backgrounds, which is a family trait, but I think that Jared's dry and sometimes caustic wit outdoes anyone else in the family. I just want to also say that with the incredible work of the Institute, the commentary, essays and countless political biographies, Anne and Jared are indeed a formidable duo and two of the most respected political and policy commentators and writers in the country, and I'm very proud to be related to them. And even though it's brought up a few surprises in the coalition party room from time to time, I also want to say that you can't take anything for granted in politics, and snapping at their heels, maybe the next generation is their daughter Elizabeth, my second cousin, and her husband Warren Mundine, or we call each other Cuz on Twitter, so that amuses a few as well. And I am very sorry that Warren was not elected as the member for Gilmore, but as I have learned in politics, never say never. My previous address to the Sydney Institute occurred not long after I was first elected as the federal member for Corangamite in 2013. I spoke about our campaign on the ground to win back one of the country's most marginal seats, led by the most formidable campaigner in Tony Abbott. After two terms, 9 months as an assistant minister, and a terrible electoral boundary redistribution, which saw Corangamite become notionally Labor, I am now very honoured, as a result of a casual vacancy with the departure of Mitch Fifield, to be standing here as a regional senator for Victoria. And I do wear that regional badge very proudly. My office is in Geelong. I'm fairly and squarely all about regional Victoria. And I'm the only Liberal senator in Victoria that is based in the regions. And I think that sends a very, very important message that in Liberals we have very, very strong representatives for regional and rural Australia. Since I was first elected, as we know, Australians have enjoyed, under Prime Ministers Abbott, Turnbull and Morrison, more than 6 years of strong and stable government, underpinned by responsible economic management that sees our budget now back in the balance, and that's a very significant achievement, knowing where it was from. There have been, yes, some ups and downs, and there are some significant global headwinds, and now we face some even more challenges, of course, in the wake of the debilitating drought, the catastrophic bushfires, and of course at the moment we're facing the coronavirus challenges. But above the cut and thrust of politics and the politicking and the toxicity of our political debate, which I believe is becoming more and more of an issue, our country continues to travel in the right direction. The fundamentals are very strong. That's because our government continues to focus on the issues which matter to Australians first and foremost. A government which understands the importance of strong economic management, of responding urgently but responsibly on the major issues confronting this nation, of tackling much needed economic reforms and of righting injustices and wrongs when required. Just a bit of a snapshot on where we are. We're in our 29th year of consecutive economic growth, a record unmatched by any other developed nation, and the Australian economy has proved to be remarkably resilient. As other countries have recently experienced negative quarters of growth, such as France, Germany, the United Kingdom and Singapore, the Australian economy continues to grow. As the RBA Governor has said, the outlook for the Australian economy is being supported by low interest rates, recent tax cuts, infrastructure spending, a brighter outlook for the resources sector, and an expected recovery in residential construction. It remains too early to know the full economic impact of the devastating bushfires. Responsible budget management, however, has given us the ability to respond to economic shocks without increasing taxes or cutting essential services. This, of course, includes our unprecedented response to the bushfires, including the $2 billion National Bushfire Recovery Fund, and also our response to the drought, with $1.3 billion committed since the election to support affected farmers and communities. Through the Morrison government's biggest tax cuts in more than a decade, a $100 billion infrastructure pipeline, including bringing forward $4.2 billion worth of infrastructure work over the next 4 years, a significant investment in 80,000 new apprenticeships and record spending on health and education, our economic plan ensures that the economy continues to grow. And as I mentioned, you have seen us also as a government respond urgently on a range of critical challenges, none more so than in the past few months. On the bushfire response, from our emergency financial aid, I think we've spent something like $110 million on one emergency payment alone, to the $2 billion fund, payments to volunteer firefighters, to significant grant support for small businesses and tourism. Of course, our response to the drought isn't just about money. We're also conducting a number of inquiries, hearing the concerns of farmers and landholders on issues like the water market and aspects of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. And of course, we've made some very tough decisions on the coronavirus, including the necessary decision to stop international flights from mainland China. Our reforms and our reform agenda span the entire economy, and just some recent reforms, and there's been many, of course, over our three terms. Family law reform, a big focus, and there's now an inquiry being headed up by Kevin Andrews, a big focus of the Attorney General, so that families are able to access support and assistance more quickly, fairly and cheaply being a big issue. On IR reform, our insuring integrity bill, which you might recall did not get through the Senate, that was a grim day last year, that remains a key priority. And just today, the Attorney General has flagged some very tough action when employers engage in systemic rorting of their staff by underpaying wages. On migration policy, to ensure we deliver greater incentives to move into and invest in our regions, there are far too many people living in Brisbane, in southeast Queensland, Melbourne and Sydney. The growth is unsustainable, and we are really focusing on a new suite of policies to address that big challenge. On climate change, by continuing to drive investment across the economy to drive down emissions, but whilst not engaging in economy-wrecking decisions which undermine our economy, our businesses, our manufacturing, our industry sector, we are a resources-based economy, and of course the need for coal is a very important need in our nation. And we're also focusing on addressing injustices and wrongs, the Hayne Royal Commission into the banks and the insurers, Royal Commissions into aged care and disability, and our national redress scheme. I don't, as a practice, talk about private conversations that I have with my colleagues, but I'm going to make an exception, and I'm sure Scott Morrison won't mind in this instance. I once asked him in a division, when he was as immigration minister, how he was able to stop the boats. And being a minister and knowing how tough it is sometimes to get things happening in government, he said to me very simply, he said, you develop really good policy and then you get on with it and you go like rocket speed. And that's what I really admire about our Prime Minister, is that he is getting on with it, leading our nation, and he is going like rocket speed. I said in my first speech, our government's election win on the 18th of May was a reminder that quiet Australians expect their governments to get out of the way whilst providing certainty, stability and confidence in the future. These are the same quiet Australians who I believe are rejecting the noisy and insidious march of the extreme left, particularly in Victoria. The animal rights groups attacking our farmers, the climate warriors gluing themselves to the streets, and the inappropriate gender-based activism in our schools and on our sporting fields. Even our basic right to speak freely is under challenge. I recently addressed an audience where I was asked not to say ladies and gentlemen for fear that these words might offend. This is obviously just silly. As for the push to declare a climate emergency, taking strong action on climate change, as I've mentioned, is important. Our government takes that responsibility seriously. And we are doing that, including by reaching our Paris targets. But I say, when it comes to addressing emergencies, please visit this Alice Springs Women's Refuge, which in reality is a homicide prevention centre for Aboriginal women and their children escaping horrific family violence. That's where you find the real emergencies. As much as I was addressing in my first speech the leftist toxic Twitterati, which dominates so much of our daily political debate, I was also raising concerns more generally about the standard of our political debate, which I think has deteriorated markedly even since I was elected. At a time when so many communities were still in the midst of a bushfire crisis, I was horrified by some of the comments being made by some politicians, who I won't name, who directly and disgracefully blamed the tragic deaths of 33 people on our government's policies, with much of the bile being directed towards our Prime Minister. It was absolutely appalling, and it is beneath any politician to speak in such a way. When I was a member for Corangamite, back in 2015, 116 homes were lost in the Wye River and Separation Creek Christmas Day bushfire, and much of the broader Great Ocean Road community was under threat, including places like Lawn and Eyre's Inlet. And yet we did not hear any of that toxic political debate, despite the fact that we were only 4 years ago also confronting an extremely serious bushfire. We were very lucky, of course, in that case there were no deaths. Just a few days ago, Paul Bongiorno, a former chief political reporter with the 10 Wint Network and now a columnist for the Saturday paper, compared Finance Minister Matthias Cormann with Goebbels, one of Hitler's key henchmen. It was, and he made these comments on Twitter, it was a shocking piece of commentary, which, as Josh Frydenberg said, showed a lack of sensitivity and understanding of history's darkest period. After several coalition MPs, including myself, called out Mr. Bongiorno, he did eventually unreservedly apologise, yet he was also egged on by plenty of like-minded individuals who applauded his stand. That sort of conduct in this day and age should simply not be tolerated, and I really do question whether Channel 10 should continue to host Mr. Bongiorno in their offices in Parliament House in Canberra. I think those sorts of standards have absolutely slipped. When I began as a journalist at the age of 17 in 1982, I'm giving away my age now, I was a cadet journalist, straight out of school, straight into the Channel 7 newsroom, and that sort of thing was completely unheard of. We had very strict standards to which we had to adhere. In fact, a number of years later, when my mother ran for politics, I could not in any way disclose my political affiliation. I was not able to join the Liberal Party. I was not able to appear in a brochure, and my poor old mother had brochures saying Anne Henderson with some of her children. But she did go on to get elected, which was terrific, and she served as a minister in the Kennett government during a glory period in Victoria. In fact, if I reflect on the sorts of standards that to which I had to live up to as a young journalist, legend has it that my very first news director, a quite fearsome and infamous man by the name of John Maher, once sacked a journalist because he used the term koala bear rather than the correct term koala. Such were the standards that we implemented in his newsroom. So I would really like to see this issue being addressed, whether it's from our politicians or from our journalists. In this sort of environment, discussion about the big challenges we face as a nation, I think, is even more difficult. But these discussions are necessary, and that's why it's these forums which are so important and add so much to the standard of political debate in our country. In my first speech as a new Senator for Victoria, I identified that we are facing some new crossroads. I said, to keep our nation strong, we must take the right road on food and water security and Australia's security and strategic interests. We've taken enormous strides to combat terrorism and foreign interference, support our intelligence agencies, and build our defence capability. Our relationships with our key allies have never been more important, but we need to call it out when things aren't working. Australia's critical infrastructure assets, our airports, power stations, data networks, communications infrastructure and ports, including the Port of Darwin, should simply not be falling into foreign hands. In October 2015, the Chinese-owned Landbridge Group won the bid for a lease of the Port of Darwin. The Northern Territory government granted the company a 99-year lease for $506 million. The Port of Darwin is a critically important strategic asset. And, of course, there is, and there has been for a number of years, broad concern that the acquisition of such a critical asset by a foreign power should never have happened. The problem with these sorts of investments is that they so often can't be wound back. As Duncan Lewis, Australia's previous ASIO head and inaugural National Security Advisor, said in Peter Harcher's excellent quarterly essay, Red Flag, espionage and foreign interference is insidious. Its effects might not be present for decades, and by then, it's too late. You wake up one day, and by then it is too late. You wake up one day and find that decisions made in our country are not in the interests of our country, not only in politics, but also in the community or in business. It takes over basically pulling the strings from offshore. I raise this issue because I think it's an important issue to raise in the context of our long-term national interest. But I do want to reiterate the government's position. We welcome foreign investment. It supports economic growth and expands trade and investment opportunities for both Australian and foreign businesses. The Foreign Investment Review Framework strikes a balance between ensuring that Australia remains an attractive investment destination whilst maintaining community confidence in foreign investment and properly protecting Australia's interests. Foreign investment proposals are reviewed on a case-by-case basis to ensure they are not contrary to Australia's national interest. Our rules facilitate productive investment whilst making sure Australia's national interest is protected. Foreign direct investment underpins our continued economic growth. It creates jobs. It improves productivity, enables the transfer of new technologies, and connects Australian businesses to global supply chains. And it supports 1 in 10 jobs in Australia and makes a significant contribution to the 1 in 5 jobs that are trade-related. I think importantly, since 2015 and since that acquisition of the Port of Darwin, the government has introduced a series of reforms to protect and promote the national interest including establishing the Critical Infrastructure Centre to enhance the scrutiny of investments in critical infrastructure, including electricity assets. The government has also introduced measures to improve transparency around foreign ownership of land and residential real estate in Australia by introducing the agriculture, water and residential real estate registers, lowering screening thresholds for agricultural investments, introducing a vacancy fee and a 50% cap on pre-approvals of foreign ownership in new residential real estate developments. The government's actions ensure Australians have every opportunity to purchase agricultural and residential land. But as I said on that day in the Senate, in my first speech, we must never forget that we are a country before we are an economy. And that means thinking long-term, squarely in Australia's interests. This is not necessarily a problem in the here and now, maybe not even in the next 5 or 10 years, but this is and likely to be a much more significant problem in the next 30 or 50 years, literally for our children and our grandchildren. Governments, I think, are often accused of thinking short-term in the 3-year political cycle, and that is tough in itself. But it is even more difficult sometimes to step out of that mould, and I've been a marginal seat campaigner for many a year, and it is a great joy to step out of that mould and to ask some of these big questions confronting our nation. I know that when I was the prospective candidate and when I became a candidate in Corangamite back in 2009, I started to campaign for the duplication of the Princes Highway between Geelong and Colac. The first section had been committed to, not commenced, and I was campaigning for that second section. And when that first section between Geelong and Winchelsea was completed, the Grattan Institute put out a report saying that this was a road to nowhere. This was an example of why governments get things so wrong. Look at this waste of money. It was $500 million all up. Nearly the full length is open now. And when, of course, so much of the infrastructure need is required in Melbourne. And yet now, just a few years later, that road is helping to service 6 million people who travel down the Great Ocean Road every year and are looking for an inland route. It is opening up so much of southwest Victoria. And I am really proud that our government looked longer term, did not look short term, and say, we know that we need this road, we need this infrastructure, not just for road safety, but for jobs, for industry, and of course, to give people living in Melbourne the incentive to move into regional Victoria. So that's why I raise these questions, and that's why I believe that for our foreign investment regime, which of course places some safeguards over our critical assets, should be out of the hands of of any foreign buyers. These are, as I say, very, very difficult questions, but I think that they are questions that your representatives should rightly be asking in the context of looking longer term at what is in Australia's best interests. In the same vein, I also believe we need to re-examine other aspects of our foreign investment laws, such as restricting, perhaps by way of allowing only leasehold, the foreign acquisition of prime agricultural land. In the latest available data, foreign ownership of Australian farmland has increased by 4%, and that's in a report by the Australian Taxation Office as at the 30th of June 2018. And in that report, it revealed that more than 2 million hectares has been acquired by overseas buyers in the preceding 12 months. The level of foreign ownership has remained relatively constant over the past 3 years, with a slight increase. It might surprise you to know that more than a quarter of land in the Northern Territory is held in foreign hands. In WA, it's 16%, in Tasmania, 24.5%. In Victoria, some 6% of farmland is foreign owned. But in Victoria, for instance, there's been a substantial growth in acquisitions by almost 10%. The short-term benefits are obvious. Increased investment, more opportunities for farmers to capture the value of spending a lifetime on the land, working hard. A strong international trade that obviously provides incentives for all nations to look at us as a great place to invest and do business. But longer term, we do need to ask really difficult questions, such as what is the cost? And when we entered into the China Free Trade Agreement, for instance, it was often argued, well, we can never lose our land. Our land will always remain with us. No one can take our land away. But we can lose much of what it produces, including our precious water, whether it's our crops, our sheep, our beef. And that does go to the heart of our country's food security. The majority of the country's land that is under foreign ownership is leasehold. It's about 81%. But I ask this question. Is it time that we started to work together, the states and the Commonwealth, to explore whether all farmland should be held as leasehold rather than freehold, so that our long-term interests can be better protected? I think it is. Do we need to examine other mechanisms to ensure that our long-term food needs are not subservient to foreign interests? I think we do. Of course, this raises the questions that our government confronts every day, and that is how to implement wide-ranging reform, often difficult reform, in the complex world of federal-state relations. In Victoria at the moment, and every state faces this, and we face this in our dealings with every state and territory, but in Victoria we face particular challenges, challenges with infrastructure. We have struggled year after year to build the East-West Link. That contract was shut down at a cost of more than $1 billion. It's a road, it's a vital piece of infrastructure which is desperately needed, and we cannot build it because we cannot get agreement with the state, with the Daniel Andrews government. We've now got some issues rolling out other aspects of our infrastructure program. I know the Infrastructure Minister, Alan Tudge, and the Prime Minister are working very hard to reach agreement with Premier Andrews. But one of the hallmark announcements in the lead up to the election was $2 billion for faster rail between Melbourne and Geelong. And there's also a $5 billion commitment to build a high-speed airport rail link, a whopping commitment of $7 billion, and we are still not yet in agreement with the state in relation to those infrastructure spends. So it is a very big challenge. We've reached agreement on other infrastructure projects, again, speaking quite locally, but we're having major issues in making sure that that infrastructure can be delivered in a timely manner. And I mentioned the Warm Ponds to South Geelong rail duplication, which is just taking far too long. Another big challenge that we have, particularly in Victoria, is energy security. We have Hazelwood closed, we have the state Labor government's 50% renewable energy target, and we have a moratorium on onshore conventional gas exploration. And we need, as the Prime Minister has said, to get the gas out from under our feet. Again, we are at loggerheads with the state on these issues, really important issues, not just for the here and now, but for the future of our country. The aim is twofold: to provide a reliable electricity grid and to lower carbon emissions. Together, a powerful future-facing strategy and one demanded by Australians. Access to domestic gas will keep the lights on when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. It's critically important to complement the role of renewables, batteries, hydrogen and pumped hydro energy storage. These might be the technologies of the future, but gas is in the here and now and fundamentally important. We do recognise that the marketplace continues to tilt away from investment in coal. Most recently, the ANZ decided not to fund any future thermal coal development following the NAB, the Commonwealth Bank and Goldman Sachs. And I have to say that they're very, very disappointing decisions because we see coal as being a fundamental part of our energy mix. But investment in gas to provide reliable baseload power becomes, under these circumstances, even more crucial. So we have this moratorium in Victoria up until the 30th of June. We are very much hoping that this moratorium will be lifted, but I say, why wait? This is critical conventional gas. It does not require fracking. It's been brought out of the ground offshore, but of course there's this sort of ideological barrier in extracting the gas onshore, which makes no sense. So the sensible decision is to break that deadlock and to see Daniel Andrews agree to unlock conventional gas onshore. So, ladies and gentlemen, whether it's our critical assets, whether it's our food and water security, our energy security, we need to remain agile. We need to remain ever questioning, and we need to never ever forget that we are here to govern for all Australians and the next generation and the one beyond that. Thank you very much.
So many thanks to Senator Henderson, and so we come to questions and discussion. So if you just come back up here, just start off. As you know, in Australian history, there's been opposition to investment in the past. There's been opposition to the left used to rail against British and American investment. In the 1980s, there was concern about Japanese investment. Do you consider the high level of Chinese investment different in any way from these previous arguments that have gone on in Australia?
Look, I'm going to be reasonably circumspect, Gerard, in how I address any particular issues with China, and I think it's fair to say that our relationship with China is a little difficult at the moment. We are having some particular challenges, and the Chinese government has made its views known in relation to the fact that we have stopped flights between here and mainland China. I certainly think that it doesn't really matter which nation it is. I think, for me, first and foremost, we are a sovereign country. And it is amazing to me when you look at Brexit and the whole debate over Brexit, and now that the UK is out of Brexit, that they agonise for so long over issues that for us and for our sovereignty are just so fundamental, protecting our borders, looking after our own trading arrangements. So I don't want to reflect in any particular way on China other than, I think there is a concern generally across the board. China is not the highest landowner of foreign land, of agricultural land. But certainly there has been a lot of concern expressed about the acquisition of the Port of Darwin, which is a critical security asset. It's, of course, it has access to the north. There are all sorts of issues with the territorial waters that China is prevailing over. And I just, as I say, I don't want to reflect particularly on China, but I think that in this day and age where we are looking, so closely at protecting our own interests, we have to be very, very careful, whether it's the UK, whether it's China, whether it's any other nation, that we put Australians first and foremost.
Senator, in 2013, you were in the House of Reps sitting behind then-Treasurer Joe Hockey when he gave Holden the ultimatum with the words, either you're with us or not. How did those words affect the decision of Holden, Ford and Toyota to stay in Australia, and you're representing an industrial city of Geelong as well?
I actually ran into Tony Abbott this morning at the Commonwealth Parliamentary Office, and I told him that I'd sent out a tweet this morning to correct an interview on Radio National because the impression was given that Ford had closed under Tony Abbott's government when he was Prime Minister. The fact of the matter is that Mitsubishi and Ford announced the closure of their operations under Labor. And for me, seeing Ford close in 2013, announce its closure, and then of course it closed 3 years later, was devastating for Geelong. But it actually announced its closure back in July 2013. So I think what's regrettable about this debate is that Labor has tried to rewrite history. I think we should ensure that if we are going to provide the sorts of subsidies that we have provided to the car industry, that Australians get good value for money. And I think that's what Joe Hockey was saying. He was saying, you are with us. And the Prime Minister today, he's angry. He has made the comment that we have spent some $2 billion on subsidising Holden, and with very little notice, arguably no notice, they've made this pretty devastating announcement. The only thing that I will say about Ford's announcement is that they gave their workforce 3 years to adjust, to retrain, to be re-employed, and we worked very closely with Ford to ensure that there were as smoother bumps as possible in terms of the transition of those workers. And I will also say, Geelong being a big manufacturing and industry town, when we were elected, everyone thought this is the end. I mean, we were on our knees, but we have worked incredibly hard as a government to drive investment into our region, to grow a more diverse economy, and we've been able to withstand not just the closure of Ford, but also Alcoa. But today is a very dark day for the car industry. It is very disappointing. I think that Holden has acted with a fair degree of disrespect to the government, to the Australian people, including to its own workers, and I can only hope that the transition, that workers are given enough time to transition properly so that we can make sure that all those workers are re-employed and that their families know that they've got a certain future.
Sarah, thank you for your talk. My name is... Yes, Dad. Can everyone hear me now?
Yes.
On the question of the Darwin Port, a group of people knew that I was coming along tonight and had a debate about what question I should ask. And you'll be pleased to know that only one question came out of a 30-minute and more discussion. And that goes to the point that you've raised. And a principle of reform that they suggested came under the heading of equivalence. In other words, a foreign investor can only invest in this country under the same conditions as would apply to an Australian investor in their country. That would cut a lot of Gordian knots.
Well, Owen, I think that would be very confusing, because you'd be asking us to implement 10 or 15 or 20 different types of laws. And I don't think that goes well for certainty of investment.
You're mentioning one Northern Asian actor.
Can we just...
I appreciate that. But you're suggesting that we should have different laws, well, an equivalence of laws, depending on who we're dealing with. That's obviously not really possible. I know, of course, in some countries, including China, even Indonesia, you can purchase freehold land. There's a very strong system of leasehold land in the UK. This is a really tough question for us because, we have to navigate this very complex federal-state relationship, many levels of government, many, different jurisdictions, all of which have their own interests. But I do think that we need to ask these big questions. I don't know that we necessarily need to implement the sorts of laws that are in China which apply to Australians. But I think that in some respects we have been too generous. I think we have been too generous, that we have taken our eye off the ball in years gone by. In recent years, of course, and I say we collectively, not reflecting on our government, but I think we didn't see this onslaught coming, and I think the Port of Darwin is an incredibly strategic acquisition for reasons that I won't necessarily mention, but we've got some very important security assets further south of the Port of Darwin, and I think that we do need to start to really ask these very difficult questions about whether we should stop any sort of acquisition like that in future.
Fred.
Thank you, Sarah. I'd like you to clarify your idea about private agricultural land and leasehold. Are you saying that existing freehold should be retrospectively converted to leasehold? Or you're saying this is only prospective and it's only foreigners? What about Australian companies that have majority foreign ownership, such as fund managers and so on? So what are the details? It seems very vague.
Fred, lovely to hear from you. And for those who don't know, I worked with Fred when I was a lawyer at Allens. And one of the fundamentals of what I was taught as a lawyer is retrospectivity is a very dangerous place to go. So I'm certainly not suggesting that we would unravel people's land holdings, and I'm not suggesting that we would radically impact on people's lives by taking away what they own. And it is vague, and it's deliberately vague, Fred, because these questions are big questions. This would fundamentally change forever the way we hold land in Australia. But, even to touch on this issue of equivalence, we can't get any sort of balance, I guess, in terms of some of our other trading partners unless we start to ask these big questions. So I don't like the idea of any sort of retrospectivity. We do have a lot of land under leasehold. And I think, this is something that could not be implemented quickly. I mean, even to start to bring an agenda together between the states and the Commonwealth on this issue is very complex because it's not front and centre. So I'm really raising questions that probably don't concern too many Australians. I know they concern some Australians, They certainly concern me. But they don't probably concern too many Australians now or maybe in the next 5 or 10 years. But I think this is going to be more and more of an issue because more countries, not just China, but other parts of Asia, will look to Australia as a place of food security, of water security, and they will look to start exporting their produce to ensure that they can feed their own people. And I think this is a very, very tough and complex question, but one that we need to grapple with. And as a very early start, I'd like to see some sort of, you know, COAG-related discussion that we can start to look at some of these big questions. I mean, I even look at some of the airports, including Avalon Airport in my own region, which has now become international. It's a fabulous asset for Geelong and Victoria. And then there's Point Wilson, which, of course, is going to be reopened as an ammunition port. And, of course, it's got, you know, high levels of security issues surrounding it. And then there's some other nearby, you know, defence-related assets as well. And so, you know, we have to ask those big questions to make sure that we are looking after these precious assets now and, you know, into the future. Perhaps well after my lifetime. But, you know, we have to start to raise these questions 30, for what our nation is going to confront 30 and 50 years' time and even 100 years' time plus.
Question to you, Speaker.
Thanks for joining us this evening. Could I ask a question about investments, Australian investments overseas, and particularly into Asia? And since we have by our standards, a very large industry super funds, how could they be directed in a orderly manner into Asia and Southeast Asia?
Well, there are certain complexities in mandating our superannuation funds to invest in certain in assets or certain investments because our trustees of superannuation funds have got to act in the best interests of their members. And this has been a particular frustration of mine because there's a wonderful company in Geelong called Carbon Revolution, which recently floated and has now gone public, but it had some real challenges raising the finance. And I raised the question, you know, why can't our super funds be looking to these incredible investments and manufacturers and industries in Australia? To support their growth, and that, for those who don't know, Carbon Revolution is on track to producing 250,000 carbon fibre wheels. It's done deals with Ferrari and Ford in the US, and it's an absolute powerhouse, and very soon it will be bigger than Ford in Geelong, and just imagine that. And we started to support that company and invest in it from 2013, not long after we were elected. So I am frustrated about the trillions that's floating around in our superannuation funds, but I'm not sure. It is very complex to mandate the investment of super funds, but if I had my choice, I would like to be mandating investment in assets in our nation, manufacturing, industry and infrastructure. I've never been to Tokyo. I'm much looking forward to going because I have a passion about trains. I think we are becoming going further and further backward in terms of our fast rail. We should have the very best rail service around this country, and it staggers me that we are really, I think, in the dark ages. I mean, our rail service between Geelong and Melbourne is slower than it was in the 1980s. The regional rail link that was developed is now being overrun by massive growth, more stations, and so I would like to see a change in our laws governing superannuation funds, but that's where I'd like them to be putting their money.
Thanks, Sarah. Your comments about the COAG activities remind me of 1942
In 1942, we changed from giving the states the power to have an income tax so that states could really decide exactly what they were going to do with their policies. You wouldn't need a Department of Education in Canberra with 2,000 employees in it. But you've got to give the states to do that. Now, I know that that's a subject that both from the Commonwealth point of view, that it's a crude power to itself, and the states that don't want to be able to continue to blame the Commonwealth for its problems. But surely that has to be the way in which you get the competition back between the states instead of all of this horizontal equalisation, which is over the top.
Okay.
Look, I think this is one of the biggest challenges we face. There is so much duplication in schools, in hospitals, even building roads and rail. It is a source of immense frustration. We have some, I think, major constitutional issues that will have to be resolved. And while, you know, we can step back and say to the states, look, you have constitutional responsibility for delivering schools and schools funding, you know, we are now a major player in that space, and that funding that we provide is critically important funding. But it is, I agree, the duplication. We have thousands of public servants in you know, health and education that don't run hospitals or run schools. And, you know, we have to do a better job.
There's a question. Anne,
I just want to pass on a question from one of our members who's either in Hong Kong or Singapore, but he wants to know why we don't insist that buyers of real estate in Australia have to make evident that they are either citizens or permanent residents. And I don't know whether that's correct, but in his view, that would be one of the problems with the bubble that's developed over apartment building in Melbourne, Sydney, Brisbane.
Well, and we have clamped down a lot on residential investment by foreign buyers. So there's, and we've actually seen the figures come back a bit as a result. So there's been quite a substantial change in allowing foreign investors to purchase existing real estate as distinct from buying off the plan. Certainly, we could see the prices were being driven high. And that was causing massive issues, particularly in Melbourne and Sydney. So we have seen that being addressed to a large degree. I mean, we want you know, to keep our doors open. That's incredibly important. But we've got to make sure that it's in a balanced and measured way. That balance was completely lost a number of years ago. We've fixed that, and I think we have seen a lot of improvements because we just can't... I mean, our house prices... on world standards, incredibly high in any event. As a government, we're working very hard, including by doing things like the First Home Buyers Deposit Scheme, which is driving the ability for young home buyers to invest in their own house. But we have got to, you know, we've got to be continuing to be nimble on house prices, but certainly that's an issue that we have certainly addressed and we've seen some major improvements.
Question here, then we go to Jonathan.
Welcome back to the finest city and the finest institute. 1942 was mentioned, as was Darwin. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the first air raid there in 1942. My question, though, is about fuel security, because your part of the world has the former Shell refinery now run by Viva. Mm-hmm. With a lot of refineries gone in Australia, what's the government sort of looking at for fuel security for this nation?
Well, Leon, thank you very much. And yes, we do have Viva Refinery, which is an incredible business in our region. Look, this is a very major issue. And we recognise that when our fuel security gets down to 30 or 45 days, that is simply not good enough. So I know that the Energy Minister, Angus Taylor, is working very, very hard to look at the many ways, including by way of entering into some agreements with some of our allies, to see how we can shore that up. We are facing some very, very big pressures in the energy market. There's discussion, of course, and a number of companies are looking to import gas, for instance. And that's why, as I mentioned, I mean, we've got to be able to stand on our own two feet. We are a resource-rich country, and it is absurd that in Victoria we have all this gas in the ground that we're not extracting it. So we have to be energy self-sufficient And fuel security is a big part of that. But, you know, when we have these bizarre ideological policies like the moratorium against gas exploration in Victoria, you have to say the world's gone mad. And hopefully, with solid and strong and principled leadership, good decision-making, we can start to turn that around.
We're getting close to the end now, so
quickly. Could you tell us what it was like being a Liberal working in the ABC?
I was a rare species. Well, I think the ABC is facing some particular challenges, and it's funny, after I referred to the comments that Paul Bongiorno made, which were frankly appalling, and I rang a couple of my colleagues at the ABC, and they were equally appalled. One of the tough things, I think, in terms of deciphering this vexed issue is that when we're in government, much more of the firepower is directed towards the government rather than the opposition by any media. Look, I think there's been some major shortfalls by the ABC. There's no doubt about that. There has been too much of an obsession. I mean, if you look at Q&A last year, and I said to Hamish McDonald when he came to see me last year about, well, what would you like to see different? I said, well, far less bias, much more balance, a broader range of issues. You know, refugee issues are important, climate change issues are important, but sometimes when I turn the ABC on, we're just getting too much of those sorts of issues and not enough recognition that there are a whole range of issues that affect families right across this country. So I know that the ABC and some of my former colleagues are working very hard to try and fix some of this, some of these issues, but there have been times when I have been dreadfully disappointed by some of the ABC's coverage.
Now, I've got a question down there. It's going to be very brief.
In relation to the Darwin Port lease point, was it the situation that the federal government could veto Northern Territory legislation about euthanasia but had no power to prohibit the 99-year lease? Is that still the case? And does the federal government have any plans to change it?
No, we have no plans to change it, so we don't have the power to reverse that particular deal, but we did take a number of very important decisions, including establishing the Critical Infrastructure Centre so that we could better safeguard our critical infrastructure assets. I think there's broad recognition that that was a deal that should never have happened, and it probably fell through the cracks, but it has happened, and now the role for our government is to ensure that where there is any sort of foreign investment in any critical asset, that the national interest is first and foremost. You know, I, tonight, have taken it to a different level in terms of questioning whether any critical asset should fall into foreign hands. I have real concerns about that. But regrettably, that deal is not easily unwound, and it does present us with a very major challenge.
Final quick, very quick question. Is it true that the parliamentarians in the Senate are much nicer than the ones in the reps? Because you've been in both. They say they're friendlier and more likely to give hugs. And is all that true?
It's a very different place from the House of Representatives. I'm really honoured, Jared, to be sitting on the red chairs in the Senate. I have to say, one of the funniest moments I had as a new senator, it was in the first week, and of course the Greens sit closely to One Nation, and then there's the Nats, and in fact the Nats have just moved across one little section. I was sitting behind the Nats, and Bridget McKenzie said, look, we're moving, we're going to our own section, and I said, look, you're like a bad boyfriend, you keep threatening to leave but you never go anywhere. But anyway, it's a very interesting corner with the crossbench, Centre Alliance, the Nats, One Nation and the Greens. But a very memorable moment was in the very first week, something that doesn't happen in the reps. The Greens stood up and they were talking about closing the gender pay gap, which of course we've actually done that work, not the Greens, from 17% to 14%, and they were talking about the importance of of closing the gender pay gap. And then Pauline Hanson stood up and she said, well, I don't know what you're talking about because you don't believe in gender, so how can you close something that doesn't exist? And I thought, I'm really going to love it here in the Senate. Thank you very much, everyone.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.